listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's recording of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, April 5th, 2024. I'm Rachel from Drake University. Here is our first story. So this story is titled, On a Rescue Mission, by Hannah Fing Urut. So the image that accompanies this story shows a man wearing a Unity Point Health spiritual care sweater, and he is sitting in front of a bookshelf with a picture of his family and a bunch of books. The caption reads, Eric Johnson, Director of Spiritual Care at Unity Point Health's Des Moines Area Hospitals, sits for a portrait on March 11th. He has served as a chaplain in hospitals for 15 years. Chaplains, traditionally a clergy person ministering outside of a congregation, have long served in the U.S., but some conservatives are hoping to introduce the role in public schools. State lawmakers push for spiritual caregivers. This story is authored by the Associated Press. Lawmakers in more than a dozen states, including Iowa, have proposed legislation to allow spiritual chaplains in public schools, a move that proponents say will ease a youth mental health crisis, bolster staff retention, and offer spiritual care to students who can't afford or access religious schools. Conservatives also argue religious foundations will act as a rescue mission for what they say are public schools' declining values, a topic that has galvanized Republican-controlled legislatures to fight for issues such as parental oversight of curriculum, restrictions on books and instruction on gender identity, and state-funded tuition assistance for private and religious schools. But many chaplains and interfaith organizations oppose the chaplaincy campaign, calling the motivation offensive and describing the dangers of introducing a position of authority to children without clear standards or boundaries. They are going to be engaging students, sometimes when they're at their most vulnerable, and there's not going to be any checks on whether they're able to proselytize what they're able to say to kids grappling with really difficult issues, said Maureen O'Leary, organizing director at Interfaith Alliance. The organization has shared concerns with lawmakers and school boards, saying schools should be neutral spaces where students can come as their full selves, O'Leary said. This isn't a matter of being pro-religion and anti-religion, she said. This is a matter of the appropriate role of religion as it applies to public schools. Texas kicks off a national campaign. Texas became the first state to allow school chaplains under a law passed in 2023. The National School Chaplain Association, which identifies itself as a Christian chaplain ministry, says on its website it was instrumental in spearheading the Texas law. The organization is a subsidiary of Mission Generation, which was established in 1999 to bring Jesus to classrooms worldwide. In a December 2023 newsletter, NSCA celebrated Texas for starting a national movement placing God back in public education. NSCA chaplains deliver holistic care, guidance, and safety to all people all the time, regardless of their personal beliefs or non-beliefs, and the organization's statement of faith is typical of endorsing bodies, an association representative said in an email. After the bill passed, dozens of Texas chaplains representing different faiths and denominations collectively wrote to school boards, warning the law doesn't require that chaplains refrain from proselytizing at schools or what they serve students from different religious backgrounds. the law ordered more than 1,200 school districts to decide by March 1 whether they would allow chaplains as employees or volunteers. Many of the largest opted out. Houston and Austin said volunteers' roles and responsibilities were unchanged, so a volunteer wouldn't be providing chaplain services. Dallas School Board said chaplains should not be employees or volunteers at this time. Other states follow suit. In the meantime, varying school chaplain bills have been introduced in many southern and midwestern states, with mixed success. A school chaplain bill passed both chambers of the Florida legislature and awaits Governor Ron DeSantis' signature. School policy must describe the services of a volunteer chaplain and require parental consent. Indiana's proposal, which passed one chamber but failed in another, specified chaplains would provide secular services unless student and parents consent to non-secular services. Some lawmakers questioned where that line would be drawn and how a student would know. In Utah, Representative Kevin Stratton told his colleagues recent Supreme Court decisions on religious freedom provide an opportunity for school chaplains and a return to the tradition of acknowledging God in public institutions. John Johnson, his counterpart in the Utah Senate, where the proposal ultimately failed without full GOP support, said he observed an outright disdain for religious principles within our schools during committee meetings. He said that he would have consequences such as more families. He said that that would have consequences such as more families choosing alternatives to public school. It would be helpful and much easier if my colleagues would take our efforts here not as an attack but as a rescue mission, he said on the Senate floor. Increasingly, proposals from then-President Donald Trump to state governing bodies have intended to crack the firewall between church and public schools, an effort that civil liberties groups say undermines equal treatment of all faiths and threatens religious minorities. Public schools have been barred from leading students in classroom prayer since 1962, when the Supreme Court ruled it was a violation of the First Amendment clause forbidding the establishment of a government religion. The Supreme Court case brought by a coach fired for praying on the field addressed the balance between the religious and free speech rights of teachers and staff and the rights of students not to feel coerced into religious practices. The decision to back a praying football coach aligned with a series of rulings that in favor of religious plaintiffs. Concept of chaplains is very gray. Chaplains, traditionally a clergy person administering outside of a congregation, have long served in the U.S., but the modern role is very gray, said Wendy Cage, director of the Chaplaincy Innovation Lab at Brandeis University in Massachusetts, in that it's not uniform or universally understood. Chaplains serve in the U.S. Congress, military, and correctional facilities, and each has rigorous requirements for hiring and service. Hospitals, police, and fire departments, colleges, and private companies also hire chaplains with wide-ranging standards. Many chaplains have seminary or ministry training in and the endorsement of a particular faith. But chaplains serving in multicultural places also may be required to bring professional supervised training called clinical pastoral education. Major hospitals are especially likely to employ chaplains with and offer training in clinical pastoral education. Patients and their families are regularly experiencing existential crises and are vulnerable, said Eric Johnson, director of spiritual care at Unity Point Health's Des Moines area hospitals. The training helps chaplains learn how to serve untethered to their faith, so transference or reactivity doesn't get in the way of really attending to people's needs, Johnson said. So that is the end of the story, but there is another photograph that accompanies this second part. The caption reads, Eric Johnson, Center, Director of Spiritual Care at Unity Point Health's Des Moines Area Hospitals, talks with other chaplains serving under his direction on March 11th. Chaplains, traditionally a clergy person ministering outside of a congregation, have long served in the U.S., but some conservatives are hoping to introduce the role in public schools. So in this image, Eric Johnson, the director, is sitting between two women, and they appear to be having some sort of conversation or training. Okay, so moving on to the next story, which is titled Iowa AEA Restructure Praised by Governor. So the photograph that accompanies this story has a caption that reads, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signs into law legislation that will alter the funding and operations of Iowa's 9 area education agencies, and also set state funding for public schools and boost public teacher pay during a bill signing ceremony in the governor's formal office at the Iowa Capitol in Des Moines on Wednesday, March 27th. This story was written by Aaron Murphy at the Lee Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Recently enacted changes to Iowa's area education agencies, which provide special education services and other supports to public schools, represent a phenomenal place to start, Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday. Reynolds earlier this year proposed overhauling the structure and funding of Iowa's 9 AEAs, and this past week she signed into law such a proposal, albeit one that was not as sweeping as her original pitch. AEAs oversee education in Iowa students with disabilities and offer media and consulting services to schools and students in their boundaries. During a news conference Wednesday in the governor's formal office at the Iowa Capitol, Reynolds was asked whether she is satisfied with the new AEA law or whether she will bring another legislative proposal for the 2025 legislative session. I'm happy with what the bill ended up. Really, it was a phenomenal place to start, Reynolds said. I thought it was a fair and reasonable place where they ended up. Reynolds said a review of the state's AEA system was needed and that she found in the system a lack of consistency, transparency, and accountability. So there were some really good places for us to start, Reynolds said. And this comprehensive bill takes a really promising step forward to start to do all of that. Reynolds said that she will continue to speak with public school and AEA leaders moving forward. She said her proposal was never intended to do away with the AEA system, but rather to provide transparency, accountability, consistency, and, quote, to improve students' outcomes. We're building relationships and we're understanding additional things that we can look at, like categorical funding, providing more flexibility, Reynolds said. What the new law will do. Currently, federal and state special education funding goes directly to the 9 agencies. AEAs will also receive property tax funding for media services and other education services for schools in their region. Once the new law is fully implemented in the second year, 10% of state funding for special education services will remain with school districts for them to use, while 90% will continue to flow directly to the AEAs. In the second year, all state funding for other education services and media services will go directly to schools, which could use that money for AEA services or to get them from another entity. The law also creates a division in the Iowa Department of Education, up to 53 new full-time equivalent positions to provide oversight of special education services provided by the AEAs. Okay, now moving on from local news to national and world news. This news centers in the Middle East, and the story is titled Biden Warns Netanyahu. Israel must take steps to protect civilians or U.S. aid in danger. Story by Amr Madini and Zeke Miller from the Associated Press, Washington. President Joe Biden issued a stark warning to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Thursday that future U.S. support for Israel's Gaza war depends on the swift implementation of new steps to protect civilians and aid workers. Biden and Netanyahu's roughly 30-minute call just days after Israeli airstrikes killed 7 food aid workers in Gaza added a new layer of complication to the leaders' increasingly strained relationship. Biden's message marked a sharp change in his administration's support for Israel's war efforts, with Biden for the first time threatening to rethink his backing of if Israel doesn't change its tactics and allow much more humanitarian aid into Gaza. The White House would not specify what change about U.S. policy, but it could include altering military sales to Israel and America's diplomatic backing. Netanyahu's office said early Friday that his security cabinet approved immediate steps to increase the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza, including reopening a key crossing destroyed October 7th, when Hamas-led militants stormed into southern Israel. About 1,200 people, mostly Israeli civilians, were killed that day, and militants took about 250 hostages. Administration officials said before that announcement that the U.S. would assess whether the Israeli moves go far enough. Biden made clear the need for Israel to announce and implement a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers, the White House said. He made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps. Biden also told Netanyahu that reaching an immediate ceasefire in exchange for the estimated 100 hostages still held in Gaza was essential and urged such an accord without delay, the White House said. Administration officials said the conversation was direct and honest. Netanyahu's office said the Erez crossing would be temporarily opened. It also said Israel would allow its Ashdod port to be used to process aid shipments for Gaza and allow increased Jordanian aid shipments through another land crossing. The World Central Kitchen, founded by restaurateur Jose Andres to provide food relief to disaster-stricken areas, called for an independent investigation into the Israeli strikes that killed 7 of the group's staff members, including an American citizen. The White House said the U.S. had no plans for its own investigation. Now for more U.S.-specific news. This story is titled, Judge Refuses to Dismiss Trump Documents Case. Defense Lawyers Presidential Records Act Argument Rejected. By Eric Tucker from the Associated Press, Washington. A federal judge refused Thursday to throw out the classified documents prosecution against Donald Trump, turning aside defense arguments that the law permitted the former president to retain the sensitive records after he left office. Lawyers for Trump had cited a 1978 statute known as the Presidential Records Act in demanding that the case, one of the 4 against the presumptive Republican nominee, be tossed out before trial. That law requires presidents, upon leaving office, to turn over presidential records to the federal government, but permits them to retain purely personal papers. Prosecutors on Special Counsel Jack Smith's team countered that the law had no relevance to a case concerning the mishandling of classified documents and said the records Trump is alleged to have hoarded at his Mar-a-Lago estate were unquestionably presidential records, not personal files. In a 3-page order, U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon wrote that the 40-count indictment against Trump makes no reference to the Presidential Records Act. On to the next story. Drug maker to pull ALS medicine off of market. Large study showed patients didn't benefit from taking Relivero by Matthew Perrone by the Associated Press. Washington, the maker of a drug for Lou Gehrig's disease that failed in a large study, said Thursday it will pull the medicine from the market, acknowledging it didn't help patients with the deadly neurological condition. Amylyx Pharmaceuticals announced it will voluntarily halt sales and marketing of the drug in the U.S. and Canada, where new patients will no longer be able to get a prescription. Patients already taking the therapy who wish to enroll will be able to enroll, will wish to continue, will be able to enroll in a program to receive it for free. The Food and Drug Administration approved the much-debated drug Relivrio in September 2022, following a years-long campaign by patients with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. The drug's failure is a bitter disappointment for patients and advocates who have pressed the FDA and other federal agencies to fund and approve more experimental therapies for the fatal muscle-wasting disease. Relivrio's withdrawal leaves just 3 ALS medicines available to U.S. patients, only one of which has been shown to extend survival by several months. Okay, so moving on from the national news and transitioning into sports news, we have a story titled Clark Repeats as AP Player of the Year by Doug Feinberg from the Associated Press. Caitlin Clark is capping her illustrious college career with another record-breaking season and another set of prestigious awards. The Star Guard from Iowa was honored Thursday as the Associated Press Player of the Year in women's basketball for the second consecutive year. Clark received 35 votes from the 36-member national media panel that votes on the AP Top 25 each week. Cameron Brink of Stanford received the other vote. Voting was done before March Madness began. The 22-year-old Clark is the 6th player to win the award more than once and the 5th to do it in consecutive seasons. The NCAA Division I career scoring leader set numerous records while helping Iowa reach the Final Four for a second consecutive season. A semifinal matchup with UConn awaits on Friday night in Cleveland. I think that's the best part about what I get to do. I grew up having these role models and aspiring to be where I am today, Clark said. It's super special to see your impact, not only in the state of Iowa, but across the country. The image that accompanies this story is one of Caitlin Clark, where she shoots during a practice Thursday in Cleveland. The Hawkeyes will play UConn on Friday. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 5th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Rachel from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515- 243-6833. So this next story is from the economy section of the paper. The story is titled The Dangers of Deflation, and the picture that accompanies this story is of used models are shown in July at a mini dealership in Highlands Ranch, Colo. The average used car price is up 16% from 3 years ago. So it's a picture of mini cars dealership with a bunch of Mini Cooper cars. And this story is by David Zalambowski from the Associated Press. Many Americans are in a sour mood about the economy for one main reason. Prices feel too high. Maybe they're not rising as fast as they had been, but average prices are still painfully above where they were 3 years ago, and they're mostly heading higher still. Consider a 2-liter bottle of soda. In February 2021, before inflation began heating up, it cost an average of $1.67 in supermarkets across America. 3 years later, that bottle is going for $2.25, a 35% increase. Or egg prices. They soared in 2022, then fell back down, yet they're still 43% higher than they were 3 years ago. Likewise, the average used car price, it rocketed from roughly $23,000 in February 2021 to $31,000 in April 2022. By February of this year, the average was down to $26,752, but that's still up 16% from February 2021. Wouldn't it be great if prices actually fell, what economists call deflation? Who wouldn't want to fire up a time machine and return to the days before the economy rocketed out of the COVID-19 pandemic recession and sent prices soaring? At least prices are now rising more slowly. That's called disinflation. A key price gauge rose 0.3% in February, down from 0.4% in January. And compared with a year earlier, prices were up 2.5%, way down from a peak of 7.1% in mid-2022. But those incremental improvements are hardly enough to please the public, whose discontent over prices poses a risk to President Joe Biden's re-election bid. Most Americans are not just looking for disinflation, Lisa Cook, a member of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, said last year. They're looking for deflation. They want these prices to be back where they were before the pandemic. Many economists caution, though, that consumers should be careful what they wish for. Falling prices across the economy would actually be an unhealthy sign. There are more consequences from falling prices than meets the eye, the Bank of England warns. What could be so bad about lower prices? What is deflation? Deflation is a widespread and sustained drop in prices across the economy. Occasional month-to-month drops in consumer prices don't count. The United States hasn't seen genuine deflation since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Japan has experienced a much more recent bout of deflation. It is only now emerging from decades of falling prices that began with a collapse of its property and financial markets in the early 1990s. So what's wrong with deflation? Falling prices tend to discourage consumers from spending. Why buy now, after all, if you can purchase what you want, cars, furniture, appliances, vacations, at a lower price later? The reality is that the economy's health depends on steady consumer purchases. In the United States, household spending accounts for about 70% of the entire economy. If consumers were to pull back en masse to await lower prices, businesses would face intense pressure to cut prices even more to try to jumpstart sales. In the meantime, employers might have to lay off waves of employees or cut pay, or both. Unemployed people, of course, are even less likely to spend, so prices would likely keep falling. All of which risks triggering a deflationary spiral of price cuts, layoffs, more price cuts, more layoffs, and on, another recession could follow. It was to prevent that very kind of economic nastiness that explains why the Bank of Japan resorted to negative interest rates in 2016, and why the Fed kept U.S. rates near zero for 7 straight years during and after the Great Recession of 2007 to 2009. Deflation exerts another painful effect too. It hurts borrowers by making their inflation-adjusted loans more expensive. Are there any benefits of deflation? It's certainly true that Americans can make their paychecks go further when prices are falling. If food or gas prices were to tumble, households would surely find it less painful to afford groceries or their commutes to work, as long as they remained employed. Some economists even question the notion that deflation poses a serious economic threat. In 2015, researchers at the Bank for International Settlements, a forum for the world's central banks, reviewed 140 years of deflationary episodes in 38 economies and reached this conclusion. The correlation between falling prices and economic growth is weak and derives mostly from the Great Depression. But the exception was a doozy. From 1929 to 1933, U.S. economic output plummeted by a third. Prices sank by a quarter, and the unemployment rate shot up from 3% to a crushing 25%. The bank's researchers said the biggest economic risk came not from falling prices for goods and services, but rather from a free fall in the price of assets, stocks, bonds, and real estate. Those collapsing assets, in turn, can topple banks that hold crumbling investments, or that made loans to struggling real estate developers and home buyers. The damaged banks may then cut off credit, the lifeblood of the broader economy. The likely result? A painful recession. So the images that accompany this story are a picture of a carton of eggs. So egg prices are 43% higher than they were 3 years ago. This photo was taken by Charles Krupa from the Associated Press. And then another photo shows Pepsi bottles, and the photo was taken by Ted Chaffrey from the Associated Press. And before inflation began heating up in 2021, a 2-liter bottle of soda cost an average of $1.67. Now the average price is $2.25, a 35% increase. So that is the conclusion of the economies section. Okay, moving on to our next section called infrastructure. So this story explores bridges on the brink. Thousands of spans are in poor condition, according to analysis of the government's national inventory. So there are quite a few photos that come with this story. The first is of a bridge with most notably a school bus, and then a bunch of sedans and other vehicles. So this photo is taken by Ryan J. Foley from the Associated Press, and the caption reads, "Vehicles drive March 6 on the Burlington Street Bridge in Iowa City, Iowa. About 42,000 U.S. bridges are rated in poor condition, with Iowa having the greatest number of them than any other state." Okay. And then the main photograph is of the Fishing Wars Memorial Bridge in Tacoma, Washington, which has been closed indefinitely since October after the Federal Highway Administration raised safety concerns. Owners of nearby businesses say that they noticed a decrease in customers as traffic slowed on their street due to the closure. This photo was taken by Lindsay Wasson from the Associated Press. So now with the story by David A. Lieb and Michael Casey from the Associated Press. So the rapid collapse of the Baltimore Bridge that was struck by large cargo ship highlighted the importance that bridges play in the daily lives of many Americans. Six construction workers who were on the bridge are dead. Drivers of more than 30,000 vehicles that crossed the bridge daily must find a new route around or over the Patapsco River, and shipments at the port of Baltimore will be shut down for some time, forcing numerous businesses to find alternative means of getting their goods in and out of the U.S. Though the Interstate 695 bridge in Baltimore had been in satisfactory condition before the shipping collision, thousands of other bridges stand in poor shape across the U.S. due to aging piers, beams, and key structural components. Here are some takeaways from the Associated Press analysis of the more than 621,000 roadway bridges that are more than 20 feet long and are listed in the federal government's National Bridge Inventory. Thousands of poor bridges. Inspectors rate bridges using a 0 to 9 scale, with 7 or above considered good. A poor rating reflects a 4 or below on any portion of a bridge's main components. A mid-range rating is considered fair. About 42,400 U.S. bridges are in poor condition, carrying about 167 million vehicles each day, according to the federal government. Those poor bridges are on average 70 years old. Of those poor bridges, 4/5 have problems with their substructures, the legs holding them up, or there's superstructures, the arms supporting their load, and more than 15,800 of the poor bridges also were listed in poor shape a decade ago, according to the AP's analysis. Iowa has the greatest number of poor bridges, followed by Pennsylvania, Illinois, and Missouri. So, why do bridges collapse? Though unusual, the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore was not the first bridge to fall down after being struck by a ship. From 1960 to 2015, there were 35 major bridge collapses worldwide due to ship or barge collisions, with a total of 342 people killed, according to a 2018 report from the World Association for Waterborne Transport Infrastructure. 18 of those collapses happened in the United States. Though also rare, bad bridges can eventually just collapse. In January 2022, a bridge collapsed over Fern Hollow Creek in Pittsburgh, causing injuries but no deaths, just the occupants of several vehicles that were on it. Federal investigators determined the bridge's steel legs and had corroded, creating visible holes, yet inspectors failed to calculate the severity of the problem, and the city failed to follow repeated recommendations. This bridge didn't collapse just by an act of God. It collapsed because of a lack of maintenance and repair, National Transportation Safety Member Michael Graham said. So, a hit to the economy. When bridges close or collapse, there are financial consequences. 13 people died and 145 others were injured when an Interstate 35 bridge collapsed over the Mississippi River in Minneapolis in 2007. A state analysis estimated Minnesota's economy lost $60 million in 2007 to 2008 due to increased travel time and operating costs for commuters and businesses. Bridges in Providence, Rhode Island, and Tacoma, Washington are currently closed because of safety concerns. Nearby businesses have taken a hit because motorists have diverted to other routes. Marco Pacheco, who owns a liquor store along a main road in a Portuguese neighborhood of East Providence, said his business revenue is down 20% since the bridge closed late last year. But he's even more concerned about the long-term consequences. That traffic doesn't instantly come back. Folks have reshaped their patterns, their thought processes, and so on, Pacheco said. Business owners in Washington shared similar concerns about the indefinite closure of the Fishing Wharves Memorial Bridge, an industrial area near the port of Tacoma. A nearby Interstate 5 bridge provides a good alternative, but that means many motorists zoom right past an exit ramp without thinking about nearby businesses, such as a Harley-Davidson motorcycle store. Is there a peril that exists? Harley-Davidson store owner Ed Wallace asked. Yeah, absolutely. A very serious one for me as a business owner. Federal funding, a massive infrastructure law signed by President Joe Biden in 2021, directed $40 billion to bridges over 5 years, the largest dedicated bridge investment in decades. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said that law already is funding more than 7,800 bridge projects. But even that will make only a dent in an estimated $319 billion of needed bridge repairs nationwide, according to the American Road and Transportation Builders Association. The bottom line is that America's bridges need a lot of work, Buttigieg told the AP after visiting the Rhode Island Bridge. He added, "The sooner we can address those significant bridges, the less likely they will be abruptly taken out of service or, worse, experience the risk of collapse." So some of the other photos that come with this article show diverted traffic, including an ambulance on a call, passes a closed portion of the Washington Bridge on March 8th in East Providence, Rhode Island. The closure of a section of the bridge and on-ramps due to failure of some bridge components has caused a significant loss to local businesses. So the example of one of the businesses was Destination Harley-Davidson owner Ed Wallace says his Tacoma, Washington store has had a loss of sales in merchandise and motorcycles since the nearby Fishing Wars Memorial Bridge closed last year. And then the last photo included in this story show rust stains are seen on the concrete of the understructure of the Washington Bridge on March 8th in East Providence, Rhode Island. So it looks like this bridge is in disrepair. Okay, so moving on to a different section, we are in the advice and TV section now. So, today in history. Today's highlight. On April 5th, 1951, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were sentenced to death on following their conviction in New York on charges of conspiring to commit espionage for the Soviet Union. On this date, in 1614, Indian chief Powhatan's daughter Pocahontas married Englishman John Rolfe, a widower in the Virginia colony. In 1621, the Mayflower sailed from Plymouth County in present-day Massachusetts on a month-long return trip to England. In 1887, in Tuscumbia, Alabama, teacher Anne Sullivan achieved a breakthrough as her six-year-old deaf-blind pupil Helen Keller learned the meaning of the word water as spelled out in the manual alphabet. In 1976, reclusive billionaire Howard Hughes died in Houston at age 70. In 1986, two American servicemen and a Turkish woman were killed in the bombing of a West Berlin discotheque, an incident that prompted a U.S. air raid on Libya more than a week later. In 1987, Fox Broadcasting Company made its primetime TV debut by airing the situation comedy Married with Children, followed by The Tracy Ullman Show, then repeating both premiere episodes two more times in the same evening. In 1991, former Senator John Tower, Republican Texas, his daughter Marion, and 21 other people were killed in a commuter plane crash near Brunswick, Georgia. In 2008, actors Charlton Heston, big screen hero and later leader of the National Rifle Association, died in Beverly Hills, California, age 84. In 2010, an explosion of the Upper Big Branch mine near Charleston, West Virginia, killed 29 workers. In a televised rescue, 115 Chinese coal miners were freed after spending 8 days trapped in a flooded mine, surviving an accident that killed 38. In 2016, UConn won an unprecedented fourth straight women's national championship, capping another perfect season by routing Syracuse 82-51. In 2021, the Minneapolis police chief testified that former officer Derek Chauvin had violated departmental policy in pressing his knee against George Floyd's neck and keeping Floyd down after he had stopped breathing. The testimony came on the sixth day of Chauvin's murder trial. Chauvin would be convicted of murder and manslaughter. So this section was authored by the Associated Press. Okay, so on a lighter note, I will transition into lifestyles and entertainment section. This segment is called My Pet World, Taking a Skittish Dog for Walks by Kathy M. Rosenthal. Dear Kathy, my 5-year-old female golden retriever is afraid to go on walks. She will walk with me within the confines of my development, but as soon as I head out toward a main road, she stops and won't budge. She has always been a bit skittish and afraid of little things. She also refuses if someone other than me tries to take her for a walk. Any suggestions? Jeff, Holtsville, New York. Dear Jeff, first, try putting an anxiety wrap or thunder shirt on her for walks. These are anxiety-reducing clothing for dogs that helps them feel more secure. Additionally, consider putting a pheromone collar on her and giving her over-the-counter calming chews beforehand to reduce any anxiety. Next, gradually increase her exposure to new parts of the neighborhood and people. During the walk, offer plenty of praise and treats to reinforce positive behavior and reassure her that she's doing great. Keep her walks short and familiar, and gradually introduce new routes as she becomes more comfortable. During moments of hesitation or anxiety or meeting new people, stop and take a break. Let her take in the sights and smells of her surroundings, as this also helps the dog relax and feel more confident. When it comes to new people, ask them to stand farther away than normal to give her some space. Then give her treats every 10 to 20 seconds to reward her for being calm. You can let the person come gradually closer as she becomes more comfortable. After the break, encourage her to sit and reward her with a tasty treat. Praise her and resume your walk. As you do, drop treats in front of her every few steps. This food encouragement helps her take small confidence step building steps without realizing it. Use a high value treat that you wouldn't normally get any other time, like cooked chicken or dog jerky. It's also important to note any specific triggers contributing to her skittishness. By identifying these triggers, you can work on desensitizing her to them over time by gradually exposing her to new people or environments in a calm and controlled setting. I know dealing with a skittish dog can be challenging, but with patience and consistency, you can help her feel more comfortable exploring the outdoors. Dear Kathy, I read your advice to the lady whose dog would not poop in her yard, and I am writing to suggest an alternative phrase. I always think of my very proper father, who cringed whenever he heard some of the more typical words used to encourage dogs to do their business. I'm not prudish, but I do think about who's around when I might be giving such a command to my dog. I live in a community with many retired folks, and some are probably slightly offended by the exact words that made my father cringe. An alternative phrase is get busy. It is far more polite. My own Doberman always responds reliably to this command before the lights go out every night. There is a cookie after she gets busy, and we both go to bed for a comfortable night's sleep. Somewhat amusingly, she will squat and produce mirror drops if that is all she has at bedtime, but she still gets a cookie for having tried. Mary, Tucson, Arizona. Dear Mary, get busy is a polite and considerate word choice, so long as it's not something that the person would typically say in general conversation. The phrase I generally use is go potty, so I'm not sure why I chose go poop on that particular day. But please feel free to adjust any training phrases I suggest to accommodate language, culture, or personal preferences, so long as they are limited to 1 to 2 words. Pair whatever command chosen with the desired behavior every time, and the dog will eventually learn and understand what the command means. This get busy command is something every pet owner should train their dog to do. Thank you for your thoughts on this matter. It's always important to be mindful of our surroundings and choose words accordingly, even when communicating with our furry friends. Dear Kathy, I am the mom of 2 Labradoodles, Do my dogs need to stay inside or wear safety glasses during the partial part of the upcoming solar eclipse? Debbie, Long Island, New York. Dear Debbie, there is no need to worry about your pets with the upcoming eclipse. Animals do not look up at the sky or the sun, so your dog's eyes are perfectly safe. So Kathy M. Rosenthal is a longtime animal advocate, author, columnist, and pet expert who has more than 25 years in the animal welfare field. Send your pet questions, stories, and tips to Kathy at petpundit.com. Please include your name, city, and state. You can follow her at Kathy M. Rosenthal. So the image that accompanies this fun story is of a brown, really cute puppy with big paws. And this photo was sourced from Adobe Stock. Now for a brief look at this upcoming week's weather. So today looks like it's supposed to be mostly sunny, wind at 7 to 14 miles per hour, and it's supposed to be around 62 degrees. Tonight will drop down to 38 degrees with winds up to 10 to 20 miles per hour. Then Saturday is expected to be very windy, and potentially there will be a PM shower. The wind will be at 25 to 35 miles per hour. The high is 66 degrees and the low is 49 degrees. Then on Sunday, looks like they are expecting strong thunderstorms, and it'll be quite breezy again, with the wind being 10 to 20 miles per hour, the high 61 degrees and the low 41 degrees. Monday is expected to be partly sunny, partly cloudy, the wind settling down, going to about 8 to 16 miles per hour, the high 62 degrees, the low 41 degrees. And then Tuesday looks like partially cloudy, with wind at 7 to 14 miles per hour, the high 62 degrees and the low 42 degrees. Okay, so closing out, I am in the What to Watch section. So today, you can watch the Antisocial Network Memes to Mayhem on Netflix. So from the rise of QAnon to the January 6th riots, this documentary explores how a group of bored teenagers built an online community out of their shared loneliness, but accidentally shattered consensus reality in the process. Okay, and then they also recommend a film called Scoop on Netflix. So, inspired by real events, this dramatization offers an inside account of the tenacious journalism that landed an earth-shattering interview with Prince Andrew, played by Rufus Sewell, about his friendship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. From the tension of producer Sam McAllister's Billy Piper, high-stakes negotiations with Buckingham Palace, all the way to reporter Emily Matalas, played by Gillian Anderson, jaw-dropping forensic showdown with the prince, the film goes inside the story with the women who would stop at nothing to get it. So, looks like they also recommend First Time Fixer on Magnolia Network, beginning at 7 p.m. Central Time. So, this is the season premiere of this show. Jane and Josh live in Austin, Texas, but their dream is to have a vacation getaway in Palm Springs, California. For their first renovation, they've purchased a drab and dated desert house in hopes of turning it into their ideal funsy retreat. This is followed by another half-hour episode in which a couple wants to turn an antiquated California cottage into a stylish home, but they have only 10 weeks and a tiny budget. So then it looks like they have a film called One Bad Apple, a Hannah Swenson mystery, which is on Hallmark Mystery at 8 p.m. Hannah Swenson, played by Allison Sweeney, has been asked to teach a banking class at a nearby college, but her equipment is tampered with and causes an explosion. The fire department rules it an accident, but soon a colleague ends up dead, and Hannah begins to investigate what is going on, meeting a prosecuting attorney named Chad, Victor Webster, in the process. Okay, so that is a few of the films and TV shows that the Daily Nonpareil recommends. Okay, and that brings us to the end of today's reading at the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, April 5th, 2024. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Rachel from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.